I so identify with that song all my life. I've been a creature of the night. Good morning, everybody. Dr. Jana Levin is our guest. A brilliant mind indeed. Now, two of the mathematical geniuses that she wrote about, talked about tonight, Gödel, for example, how did he end? Apparently starved himself to death, fearing the food that was offered up was poisoned. So he starved himself to death. Turing, it says here, bit from a poison apple. We'll ask about that one, both, in fact, in a moment. Before we go to the phones, Doctor, just a couple of things. Gödel, starving yourself to death because you're afraid your food would be poisoned?
Yeah, as I said, he was really diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. I mean, he didn't have hallucinations, purple elephants, or anything like that. He sense of kind of logical, I'm not sure if I would call them hallucinations exactly, but paranoid fantasies. You know, they weren't totally outrageous, but they weren't true either. And he was a severe hypochondriac and used to keep incredible detailed diaries about his bodily functions and was always terrified something was going to happen to him, and that the coal in his apartment when he lived in Europe was poisoning him, which actually it might have been, but and then later when he lived here in this country, he also had very strange behavior, wearing layers and layers of clothes in the heat and the cold, you know, but in the heat, and he fell prey to these delusions that the government was trying to poison his food. And his wife, who was 8 years his senior, used to really nurse him back to health over and over again and spoon-feed him food. He was several times in his life dangerously emaciated. But when she fell ill, there was really nobody to help him. And when she became incapacitated physically, he really spiraled out of control. And he died of self-starvation.
Quite tragic. And
it's an unbelievable story. This is also why, even though the book that I wrote is fiction, I stick very close to fact, because the most incredible and strange elements in this story are true. And you can't make that stuff up.
And Turing and the poison apple?
Well, Turing comically loved the movie Snow White, and apparently it was Gödel's favorite movie, too. And this reference to the poison apple, you remember the queen poisons an apple and Snow White bites in the poison apple, and
yes.
he did commit suicide. There was some theories that the government had, in fact, poisoned Turing, but I think that that's unlikely. I think he did commit suicide, and he laced an apple with cyanide. And he bit from it. This is at a time in his life when he was recovering from hormone therapy, which he was subjected to by the British government because he had been convicted of homosexual activity, which was illegal at the time. So you have this very tragic story of this war hero who is then really betrayed by his country and essentially poisoned with these severe hormone therapies, which left him obese and depressed. And he eventually commits suicide. It's an unbelievable story. You could not make that up.
No, you couldn't. And both of them mathematical geniuses.
Absolutely. People call Gödel the most important logician since Aristotle. And certainly Turing was really a great genius. We are living in a time of incredible influence from both Gödel and Turing in terms of the world that we live in, the computer digital age, that we owe a lot to them.
All right. We're going to go to the phones. A lot of people would like to speak with you. And so away we go, all the way to Florida. Charles in Florida, you're on with Dr. Levin. Hi.
Hi. I'm absolutely fascinated with this great mind of Einstein's. I'm not a religious person traditionally, I guess, but this is a man that went from atheism to agnostic to a believer in some kind of a creator.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just tell you, I communicate and exchange telephone conversations with a nuclear physicist, and he signed a non-disclosure agreement. I'm convinced there is a very simplistic explanation in this theory of everything. And I think it does include a creator, but there is nothing but material things out there in the universe. I just tell you, I think there's three things that are very interesting. First of all, there is the standard in the universe, I believe, there is no beginning and there is no end in multiple universes, number one. Number two, there is such a diversity in size. If we went back to Roman times, and this wonderful lady brought a pocketbook with a microscope in it, and a man was coming out of a Roman bath and put a towel around him, and you grabbed his hand and put it under the microscope, he wouldn't believe what he'd see because he can't see bacteria back then. Now, I suggest to you, beyond your wildest dreams, how stupid is mankind? We believe we're the largest things in the universe. We have proportionally a view under the microscope of bacteria, and yet, on the other end of the size spectrum, is there life? I believe there is. I don't believe there's any standard other than infinity in every direction. And I believe time is amazingly observable in our lifetime. As we escalate through the universe at higher and higher velocities, our planet, we are stretching time every day, and that appearance of the stretch of time occurs with the higher and higher velocities. And as we get older, I'm getting to be pretty old, as we get older, we notice not a speeding up of time, but a stretching of time and observance of more physical events occurring in what may be a 40-day week, a month, instead of a 30-day calendar month on the wall. And I just believe there's so much fluid nature to the whole universe. Man has to stop for a minute and realize there is a consistency between biblical text and scientific fact if you connect the dots. And there
okay.
is. Yeah. Okay.
All right, caller, hold it there, and let's take a response to whatever you'd like to respond to.
Well, let's start in the beginning with the comments. I think that Einstein is sometimes referred to as being a believer in God, but that's not historically accurate. It's my understanding that Einstein used the word God often poetically, and he was very clear that he did not believe in God. Now, whether or not people out there agree with him, it's very clear that Einstein himself really did not believe in God in the sense that I think people mean. He was used the word in a poetic term, like God does not play dice, or I want to know God's thoughts. But he very clearly said that he did not believe in a supernatural entity. And again, I think, you know, yet he's very, in some sense, also a very deep spirited person. And so, and was drawn to the magic of the universes for his understanding, for his sense of meaning. I also want to say that, you know, there's an interesting way of saying, you know, I really believe, as the caller said, there are other universes out there. I really believe that time is like this, and that's interesting. You know, and I will sometimes use that to have a direction in my research. I'll say, I really believe the universe is finite. It just makes sense to me. But I know that I can change my belief system because really what matters is the evidence. And without the evidence, my belief isn't important, even to me. It's just a way that I use to have intuition, to ask good questions and to try to make scientific progress. But at the end of the day, what matters is what observations reveal to me. And if observations reveal to me something different, I'm excited about changing my mind about that. And there was just one other thing that I think is funny to comment on, that there was the caller mentioned that time seems different as we get older, that it seems as though we have more experiences or we can pack more experiences in, and that actually can be understood physically in some sense, that our psychological perception of the passage of time can have to do with changes in entropy. Entropy is a measure in a sense of information. And that when you're very young, everything is new information. You have a smaller storage of information in some sense. And everything you perceive is big changes in information. And that can make time seem slow. And our psychological perception of time will change as we get more and more information literally stored in our brains because we perceive the acquisition of information differently. So it's really actually a kind of funny thing to think about.
All right. Marty in Indianapolis, your turn with Dr. Levin.
Hi, Art. It's a real thrill to talk to you. This is I'm listening on 1070, and I must say that I love the doctor's laugh.
Thank you. Sometimes I laugh too much when I'm on the radio, I have to admit.
My question was on the nature of gravity. You used an analogy about a ping pong ball on a bedspread, and it makes sense, but it just seems like a larger version of a ball rolling down a hill. Now, why are things attracted to each other? Art, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the book, The Universe is a Green Dragon, but it seems to it tells me that this science has not explained really what gravity is. It's just an attraction, an abstract. The author uses the word love. I'm not sure if she can elaborate on what really gravity is.
Well, yeah, so I think there is something interesting. Let's say I imagine a curve in space, and I say something follows the natural curve. I think you're asking a good question, which is, why does something have to follow the curve towards the Earth? Why couldn't it follow the curve away from the Earth, for instance? How is there directional information? But the curves really do have, in some sense, directional information. They tell you how things move in time and which direction. That would go in space-time. So they're not just curves in space. They're curves in space-time. And to follow the natural curve in space-time also involves that you go towards the mass. And so really Einstein's theory being generalized to space and time does explain the attraction that ordinary masses feel towards each other. But again, we discussed this other form of energy, this dark energy, which seems to have a repulsive character, that it causes space to actually stretch and expand faster and faster. So you really have to look at this theory to see exactly what happens. But I would say that we do understand that aspect of it.
Okay. Dave in Toronto, Canada, you're on with Dr. Jen Levin. Hi.
Good morning. Doctor, if you were to take a ball, absolutely hard, no give to it, assumably, and throw it against a wall that has no give to it, assumably, when the ball bounces back to whatever degree it can bounce, does it have to stop when something changes direction, given perfect hardness or whatever, as opposed to a sponge ball? Does it have to stop completely to reverse direction? At some point, does it come to a dead stop and reverse direction?
Well, yes, if I did that idealized experiment you're talking about, you would see that the velocity came to a dead stop, but the change in the velocity, which we call the acceleration, did not come to a dead stop. It was quite the opposite. So it's because it feels its acceleration, it's causing it to speed up again in the other direction. But yes, under the deceleration, when it hits the wall, it does come to a dead stop in reverse direction.
And one, if you don't mind, if I'd like mm-hmm. to make one more point, mm-hmm. I think there is a difference between your classic genius, be it in the art realm, no joke intended, no pun intended, maybe a physicist who thinks left brain, right brain, you know, versus an artist. But geniuses, I think, are inherently different because they see a wider spectrum. So when you put them in an ordinary situation, daily life, drive a cab 9 to 5, so forth and so on, they're due to go mad because they have so much going on in their mm-hmm. head that there is simply a difference between that person and the person who's perfectly content to drive the cab, not always, but perfectly content to drive a cab 9 to 5 his whole life and never question anything. Sees the world in black and white terms. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that has to do with, I think it has to do, in fact, with the fact that the person may have an exceedingly high IQ given to strange machinations of thinking as an artist. And I think they are inherently different. Could you elaborate on that? I'll be off the phone. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I think that it's a fair point to be taken that the types of people who are really examining the world that they're in at all times might be vulnerable to more extreme highs and lows because there's more rapture and there's more devastation and more sorrow. And so I think, right, that extremity, you know, I can understand why people feel that there is a psychological link, but whether or not this is a biological link is what I don't know, or what I wouldn't want to conjecture. I don't believe that you have to be biologically different and literally the chemicals in your brain to be this way. I think that there are, you know, character choices. There's the choice to examine the world we live in, or the choice to put blinders on, and that might have more to do with character than with biology. But who am I to say I'm not a neuroscientist or a cognitive scientist or a behavioral scientist? So maybe those people can team together to say.
He makes a good point, though. He really does. Okay, here's John in Linwood, Washington. You're on the air with Dr. Levin. Hi.
Yeah. Hi, Art. Can you hear me? Okay.
I hear you fine.
Yeah, a pleasure to talk to you. I enjoy your program. I got a question about time travel. Personally, I kind of question that. And so I'm wondering if the doctor could kind of present the scenario that most people would propose at this point in time. Would it be like a machine or incantation, or how would that
well,
be?
Well, all right, we kind of covered that earlier, and she suggested that time travel to the future is certainly possible under certain conditions and probably not to the past at all.
But how would it happen? What mechanism?
Well, I can only see this. You can imagine a whole universe that's kind of rigged to allow that to happen, but I don't think anyone has imagined a machine that you could build in a laboratory. And so, you know, I don't think people really take seriously that they're going to build a machine to make time travel happen. I think they're just curious about what it means philosophically, if it's possible, even in a hypothetical universe that rotates or with crossing strings or some other very peculiar circumstance, which you could not reproduce in a laboratory.
What about wormholes?
Well, wormholes don't necessarily induce time travel. They just connect two regions of space. So it's like saying, suppose I want to get from New York to New Jersey, but I think I have to go the long way around the globe. So it's going to take me a very long time. And then I discover I can go the short way around. I mean, a wormhole can provide a short bridge between two regions of space-time that seem like they're far apart. And then you find out there's this little bridge making them closer together. They don't necessarily, unless they're very peculiar, you know, unless they're rigged in some very peculiar way, mean that they're going to cause travel backwards in time.
The event horizon of a black hole?
The event horizon of a black hole does not induce time travel. It does slow down time relative to an observer far away. So let's say some poor astronaut is falling in towards a black hole, and I'm safe distance away in a spaceship, and I'm watching them. It would look to me like it's taking an infinite amount of time for them to fall through the black hole. But the astronaut, as far as they're concerned, thinks they passed right through the event horizon and right through to the down the throat of the black hole. So our perceptions of time become extremely relative.
Mm-hmm. Any danger in CERN's work? They actually may produce a small black hole. Any concerns about that, Doctor?
Yeah, I have no concerns about that. I think that I think that's kind of fascinating, grabs people's imaginations. But no, I don't think something like that's going to happen. I think the energy scales that CERN's talking about, and what's physically possible, it's all very safe stuff. And that experiment is a very important experiment because it's going to reproduce conditions much earlier in the universe's history in a way that we've never been anywhere near before. And so we could learn a lot, for instance, even about the existence of extra dimensions. There might be a way to see if there are extra dimensions by going to these high energies. So it's really exciting. A lot of
careers hanging on what might happen there?
In a way, yeah. A lot of careers are hanging on some of the results. And, of course, many, many people have been involved in building the experiment itself.
Indeed so. All right. Hold tight. Dr. Jana Levin is my guest. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM, talking about the things I just love to talk about, that which is all around us. That which we still don't fully understand. From the high desert, we'll be back with more in a moment. Here I am, Dr. Jana Levin is my guest, a great mind, obviously. Here's a kind of an interesting article that I'll expand on tomorrow night. There's so very much up there. Astronomers have detected water in the atmosphere of a planet outside our solar system for the first time. The finding, to be detailed in an upcoming issue of Astrophysical Journal, confirms previous theories that say water vapor should be present in the atmospheres of nearly all the known extrasolar planets. Even hot Jupiters, gaseous planets that orbit closer to their stars, and Mercury to our sun are thought to have water. The discovery, announced today, a couple of days ago now, means one of the most crucial elements for life as we know it can exist around planets orbiting other stars. And there seem to be an infinite number of other stars, so much more than we can even imagine. So, aren't the odds on our side? Even if there's no soul, immortal soul, if there's no God, with all we know and all we can see, let's ask the good doctor, doesn't there have to be other life out there? Other life, very much perhaps like us. We'll be right back. Doctor, if we're not this wonderfully created race by God, we're not this unusual, rare thing, and we look out and the first planet we see around another sun has the building blocks of life, isn't it almost a sure bet that out there there is life very much like ours?
Well, I would say half of that I totally agree with. I agree that it's extremely likely there is other life out there. I am not convinced it's extremely likely they're anything like us. If we look at the history of life on the planet, we're a really unsuccessful species. We've only been around for, 100,000 years, and in the past 100, where we've nearly wrecked the planet completely with industrial revolution. And there's no evidence that we're a successful species. We might come and go in the bleep of an eye if we're not careful. And a very successful set of animals are animals like dinosaurs. They were roaming the planet for hundreds of millions of years, and they never destroyed the planet. And so if we also look at the variety of life on the Earth, from microorganisms to the wild and rich number of organisms in the oceans, why should we think that another life form looks just like us? I think that's the part that is a wild leap for me personally. And I think, if you counted literally probabilities, is it very likely that on another planet organisms just like us evolved? And that doesn't seem likely at all. But what does seem likely is that there's other life. Maybe they're only amoebas. Or maybe there was a civilization that came and went. Or maybe, they breathe a different kind of air and they have different numbers of limbs and, that everything's totally different. Maybe they float. I mean, who knows the variety of things we could imagine. And if we just look at our planet, again, we see the variety is beyond our imagination, really. We discover things that we didn't know were possible.
How likely, Doctor, do you think it is that we're going to be around as human beings will be around long enough to begin to answer some of these impossibly important questions about how we got here?
Well, I think we've already made so many discoveries. I think that there's this, one of the callers also brought this up, this sort of double-edged quality between knowing more about the universe and feeling insignificant as a result, feeling not special. We're not at the center of the solar system. Maybe we're not a chosen species put down here. Mm. And, maybe we have to confront these things that seem painful and difficult and demeaning. And yet, in the very process of understanding that we orbit the sun and that there was a beginning to the universe and that we have a certain place in the history of the cosmos, I think that should make us feel very significant, very special, that we do have an ability to know the universe and relate to it in that way. So do I think that our species will be around long enough to unravel
yes.
all of these mysteries? I think that we will continue to unravel great mysteries as long as we're around and hopefully, we'll wise up about our place on this planet and the sanctity of this of life on this planet.
Before we destroy ourselves.
That's right.
Okay, off to just over the hill from me, Las Vegas. Kish, I believe it is. You're on the air with Dr. Levin.
Hi, Art. Good evening, Dr. Levin. Good to hear you. Art, before I say something, I just want to tell you I'm 42 years old, and I remember listening to you as a teenager on 7:20 a.m. My mom
yes.
would have to come in and tell me to turn the radio off because I've been an insomniac ever since I was a child.
It's been a while.
So thank you for many years of fascinating, mind-bending, wonderful topics.
Thank you.
Doctor, first let me say respectfully that I'm going to disagree with just about everything you've said, And I'm not about to question your academic credentials. It's obvious that you're a very brilliant woman. But I remember a time when people used to say the theory of evolution. And nobody found the missing link. Nobody proved anything. But we dropped theory. And we just started saying, yep, we proved it. And I've heard you tonight say, oh, it's proven. You know, I can prove it. I can prove it. I can prove it. And then I've heard you say, I think, I believe, I want to believe, I can't wrap my arms around. And respectfully, when you said, Einstein, you know, spoke poetically of a God. No, he didn't. I want to know God's thoughts. The rest are details. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. I mean, he has so many references to God. Most of all, my religion consists of a humble admiration of an immitigable superior spirit who reveals himself in the details we are unable to perceive with our frail and feeble minds. The Big Bang Theory, Art asked you early on if you believed in the Big Bang Theory, and you said absolutely. And I want one person, one brilliant person such as yourself, to sit down with me and show me how mathematically, because it's impossible, it can't be done, how mathematically the sun was placed in a perfect spot so that we weren't burned up or that we didn't freeze, that the moon was put in a perfect place, that the tides worked, that one planet in our universe rotates the opposite direction of all of the other planets in the universe. God bless you. I know you've gone to school and you've worked hard, and I'm not even going to begin to compare my academic background to yours because you're obviously a very brilliant woman. But when did we make all of these theories truths without any change in fact?
Can I jump in now?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
No, so I absolutely appreciate your skepticism, and it's fair to be skeptical and try to look for the evidence yourself. But it's not the case that we're just saying this is true without fact. It's really not the case. You have to remember, Einstein did not want to believe that the universe was expanding. He did not want to believe in the Big Bang. It was the overwhelming observational evidence that made him change his mind. And that is what we're talking about. We're not talking about people wanting to believe in the Big Bang or having this fantasy about it. And there was a time when we didn't know one way or the other, and then you do look at the evidence. And I have to say, it's not true that you cannot prove mathematically why planets are in the locations that there are. You can mathematically prove why there are stable locations for the planets. And if you align a whole bunch of planets in all of the possible stable locations, one of them happens to be special, the Earth. We are on the Earth not because it is in this location, and that's why we're not on Venus, and that's why we're not on Jupiter. It's not, human beings evolving on the surface of Jupiter because the conditions are so different at those other stable points. So it's really not that case. I can prove that to you mathematically, and I can use very simple mathematics to do it. Very old-fashioned, pre-20th century mathematics and physics to do that.
But Einstein coming around to an expanding universe doesn't necessarily indicate that he believed in the Big Bang Theory. I don't believe in the Big Bang Theory, and I believe in an expanding universe because God said that my creations are without number.
Well, Einstein did believe in the Big Bang Theory, because by the Big Bang Theory, what we mean is that there was a period of extremely hot primordial soup which underwent afterwards a rapid expansion, and we have lots of detailed evidence that that's the case. We can chart that 3 minutes after the universe was created, that elements should have been synthesized in a particular abundance, ratio of abundances. And in fact, that is confirmed by observations to stunning accuracy, really exciting and impressive result. And we also can measure something called the cosmic background radiation, which is a glow and a heat left over from the Big Bang. Now, these are very, very strong observations, and we can study these in detail. And in fact, the Nobel Prize in 2006 was awarded to people who had measured this radiation left over from the Big Bang to such stunning accuracy and revealed all of these details about the early history of the cosmos. So I just absolutely must lay down that it is not the case that we simply believe this because we want to believe this. We believe this because the evidence is overwhelming.
But I go back to the start of my argument when you reference the people who won the Nobel Prize that they proved this about the Big Bang Theory is based on other assumed assumptions that we have taken for granted. So, yep, okay, some scientists said this. We're able to say 2 + 2, so yeah, everybody's going to agree with that. The scientific community is. But it still goes back to the fact that there are 12 million.
Listen, can I just interrupt you for a second? I'm not sure what you're saying, but they believe it because it's a theory. I might have a theory of electromagnetism and radiation and light, and yet it's really not about my theory. If I walk into a room and I turn on the switch, I have a measurement and experience that the room is full of light. It either is or it isn't. And so these are observations of light, of simple electromagnetic radiation. They're not difficult or abstract or surreal. They're really just like pointing a telescope in the sky and seeing something. It's not about my theory whether or not I'm seeing something out there. My detectors are picking up electromagnetic radiation. We are seeing things out there. We are seeing galaxies out there. We're seeing them expand, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this it's true that our theories shape how we interpret that data, but we simply are living in a bath of radiation that's very cool, that matches our predictions for what the Big Bang should be leaving today to incredible accuracy. And not only that, but this radiation is exactly the same in every direction that we look, to one part in 100,000. It's an absolutely stunning observation. It is not like anything else we've ever seen before, and that's why the Nobel Prize keeps being doled out for this discovery, because it is so incredibly impressive.
Like I said, I had no intention of being disrespectful. It's been a fascinating show. I've loved listening to you. I agree with one caller. You have a wonderful laugh. But I think the most valuable thing that Einstein left us was the single quote where he said, "Science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind." 100 years ago, no scientist would have thought of advancing a theory that did not have biblical or theological backing. Now, I'm playing devil's advocate here. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm just saying that I'm 42 years old, and I remember in school everybody talking about the theory of, and I know we're talking about Big Bang, and I'm kind of mixing two of them, but I always remember the theory of evolution, the theory of evolution, the theory of evolution, and now I have teenagers in high school, and I'm at, you know, meet the teacher day and everything, and all of a sudden I'm hearing about the fact of evolution. Mm-hmm. Did somebody discover the missing link? Did I miss that?
Let me just say that I appreciate skepticism, and I think all scientists have to be skeptical. I think that especially at the time when people were discovering the Big Bang and the radiation, even the discoverers, just to put it in perspective, were very skeptical about what they had observed. They didn't believe that this was the radiation left over from the Big Bang. It was too much for them, and they weren't even sure they believed in the Big Bang. And so it's really what I love about this kind of discovery is that it's not about belief, and that they were forced to change their minds and they were forced to accept the evidence. And so I think that is why it's so important to make clear that there is evidence for this. And as for believing that science is compatible with religion or not, you know, people can frame that in different ways. And, you know, I certainly don't disrespect other people's belief systems, but I think it's very important not to claim that the Big Bang is simply some belief system I have that doesn't have evidence. That's all that I think is important to make clear.
How do you interpret what he quoted Einstein as saying about science?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. I mean, again, you could probably turn to a historian of science, but there are many direct quotes where he very clearly stated in no uncertain terms that he did not believe in a supernatural entity. And so, you know, whether people want to argue that he went in and out of his convictions, I think is unlikely. But I don't think it really matters. You know, Einstein, that was belief. It's not a matter of just accepting Einstein's beliefs because he was a great mind. That's not what we do. We look at Einstein's theories and we scrutinize them with great skepticism and we test them against observations. And that's what's made it survive, not because he was a great mind who believed something and therefore we believe it too. So I don't think it should really matter one way or another if Einstein believed in God. That's not really relevant. And what's relevant is what's testable and what's reproducible and what we can all share in common, and verify for ourselves.
All right. Tommy in Seattle, you're on with Dr. Levin.
Dr. Levin, hello. Hi, Art.
Hi.
Here's your chance to be incredulous. Bear with me a few moments to the fantastic circumstances behind my question. I'm standing on an alien planet on the surface, and I'm watching flying saucers disgorge from the mothership, and I asked, how does interstellar travel work? And I got these series of mental images of studying a quantum singularity of nearby black hole for several hundred thousand years. And they coupled this with tapping the natural energy of the universe into creating immense gravitational fields to the point where time does not exist. And this is used for instantaneous interstellar travel, according to what they told me. Now, this is sort of like a beam that goes from here to there, like a laser beam, and they enter this field and drift a few feet, turn it off, and they're there. No elapsed time involved between going from here to Aldebaran or wherever and back. And I'd like your comments on the feasibility of that.
Well, Art, do you have comments on the feasibility of that?
No.
Yeah, I think that's probably beyond the scope of my expertise.
I do wonder, though, Doctor. I mean, we've had thousands and tens of thousands of incredible sightings of things that apparently have been visiting this planet, and so many that one has to wonder if there is other life out there, and other life has managed to make an incredible journey. Perhaps we are being monitored since the discovery of Element 92. Perhaps we bear watching, and we are being watched. It could be so, Doctor. Who knows?
Well, I think if you look back in the history of our own history and when we first developed, let's say, tools or transportation, we're talking 100 years, not very long, that we've been able to fly, or it's not even that long, and certainly, cars are, it's all in the past a couple hundred years that we've had that kind of industrial revolution, that we've had those capabilities. So in the history of 14 billion years, that's just a bleep of a second. So I again have to ask, why is it that there's another civilization that's doing the exact same thing at the exact same time in this bleep in history? That's what seems really unlikely to me. But, throwing probabilities out there.
John in Oklahoma, you're on with Dr. Levin. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Had a bunch of questions, but probably don't have time for them. I was wondering what your definition would be of the word universe.
Oh, well, it's a good question, really. I mean, by universe, I really mean space-time. So it's a good question, because if I imagine that this, what we're used to calling a universe, that is to say this plume, this bubble, or this expanding space-time from what looked like a hot, early, rapidly expanding, what we now call Big Bang type of episode, if that is really just like a branch off a tree, or if I imagine the ginger root, just a bubble off the ginger root, and then there are, loosely speaking, other universes out there, other bubbles and other plumes, I'm inclined to call all of them one big universe, a megaverse, so to speak, and just to say that this is our patch of the megaverse, and this might be the only patch that we'll ever be able to know about or ever be able to communicate with, but it is smoothly connected in some sense to a larger space-time. So to me, the universe is space-time and any continuous flow between space-time.
Doctor, it has been such a pleasure having you on the program. You've really been a joy. You've got two books, A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines and How the Universe Got Its Spots, Diary of a Finite Time in a Finite Space. So, Doctor, thank you, and surely we will have you back again.
Thank you so much, Art. It was really a lot of fun.
It was fun. Good night, Doctor.
Good night.
And for everybody else, back tomorrow night with more. So for this night and the middle of this weekend from the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Good night, all.